My name's Peter Thompson. I'm from Minneapolis. I'm a retired lawyer. I'm kind of a Holden junkie for the last 25 years. As Dan Erlander walked in and as Katie walked in, what's your last name?
Geisbury.
Yeah. I recruited both of them to help me teach tonight in Holden fashion. The other thing about Holden fashion is that I ran into a lot of people today and they said, when's your session? And I said, 8:30. And luckily, when I was eating in the dining hall, I heard that it was at 6:15. I was able to get up and take a shower, so at least I smell good. So if I get a little screwed up, you'll understand why. So what we've been doing this week is looking at some issues of war and peace and justice from some different lenses, both of discipleship and citizenship. And so we took a little journey through a prosecution that's going on now in the military commissions against a man named Omar Khadr, who is a boy. Now a man, but he's been in Guantanamo for those 8 years. So we went through his arrest at a firefight, his torture, and then his prosecution. And his trial is actually scheduled for a couple weeks from now. He's a Canadian citizen, originally from Pakistan. And there were some lawyers who were pretty complicit in this whole thing, and we had a discussion last night about some of those lawyers and the ethics or lack thereof that has contributed to a lot of the torture that's been done over time. So we've been very current for the first 4 days, and we're going to get quite historical today. And today what we're going to try and do is look back at the tradition that has grown up, not without considerable support from Christians, of justifiable war. And when we get toward the end of that, we're going to have a PowerPoint for that. When we get toward the end of that, we're going to look at one of the real important criteria of justifiable war, and that is, the idea is war is supposed to end with peace. War is supposed to give us peace. That's right in the justifiable war tradition. And I don't know why they think that. Because if you look at the history of America, if I were to look back when you took American history, basically it's all about war. You know, we never really get this lasting or just peace. You know, we start out with the Revolutionary War and we go to the Civil War and we get the Spanish-American War and we get World War I and we get World War II and we get Vietnam and now we got
Korea,
and then we get the bunch that we're involved in now. And that's really how history's taught. So, is there another way to go about this? And so then at that point, I'm gonna first ask Katie to summarize what probably most of you missed, because you might not have been here, but I call it Nonviolence 101, which I first heard from Dan Erlander up here, which is Walter Wink's theory about what was really going on in the Bible with Jesus when he said on the Sermon on the Mount, turn the other cheek, those sorts of things. So she'll give you a little summary because we were both at that class. And then we'll kind of look at the idea of how traditionally Christians and Rome have viewed how you get to the end of peace, what peace is. And from that, then the rest of the time we'll spend talking about nonviolence in this standpoint. There's all sorts of wonderful things that have been talked about nonviolence, and usually in kind of a vague way. There's a guy named Gene Sharp who's written several volumes about nonviolence in a very scholarly fashion. And his theory basically is, you know, not only what I just said, war hasn't worked, so why don't we try something else, but that no one has ever taken nonviolence seriously. You look at events in history and don't see them as nonviolent successes or ways that nonviolence really has worked in certain circumstances. You know, maybe not permanently, some permanently, and all sorts of other, you know, combinations and permutations. But he says, that until people are convinced there's a better alternative than war, that is, that, you know, nonviolence could be workable, could work, that we're just going to keep doing war. So we can beat the drums about banning war forever, and his theory is war will never be banned until people believe that there's a way that's going to work, different than war. And so he suggests a serious study of nonviolence, serious education about nonviolence and peacemaking, and serious breakthroughs in the whole paradigm about the way society thinks. And at that point, we can maybe change, because people will think, wow, this isn't just silliness. This isn't stupid. Steph?
He suggests that for America.
He suggests that for the world.
For the world, okay.
Most prominently for America.
Okay.
I think he's English, actually. But yeah, he suggests that.
Globally.
Yeah, globally. And so what I'm going to do is just, in some of my various readings, and I teach some of this stuff at law schools back in the Twin Cities, what I'm going to do is just tick off a whole bunch of events anecdotally that tend to indicate that nonviolence can be effective. And it'll surprise you, a lot of them you probably would have thought about, but you wouldn't think of them like, oh, yeah, that was nonviolence. You just think of them as a political event you heard about. So I'll just go through a bunch of those, and that'll probably take more time than we've got. And then we're going to start next week. This week for me was kind of war. And next week we're going to kind of do more nonviolence. Next week, just to give you a little thing, on Monday, we're going to look at Obama's acceptance speech of the Nobel Peace Prize during the same time he was sending 30,000 new troops to Afghanistan. And I have recruited Reinhold Niebuhr to come here and give some of his views of the anomaly and the irony of the speech from a Christian realist standpoint. I have recruited a conservative commentator to give his or her views. I haven't decided which gender it'll be yet. I know Reinhold Niebuhr will be a male because I've already recruited him. And then we will also have Father John Deere, who is a Roman Catholic priest and longtime nonviolent activist. And each of those people will give their view of Obama's Nobel speech and what issues it raises for them. And then we're going to look at civil disobedience. Then the day after that, we're going to look at one of my most famous clients, Father Roy Bourgeois, a representative for 12 years on School of the Americas, and his story and why he is called to divine obedience, as he calls his civil disobedience. So, any questions about kind of where we're heading and where we've been? And thank you very much, Katie and Dan. I would have felt very silly, I know he was going to come tonight, being in the room with Dan, teaching something that he taught me. You know, I mean, this guy is, he's our leader. So, we've got so much ground to cover that we're never going to get to a point like I like to get to at the end to say, okay, what do we think about this question, this question, this question? So as they come up during the time we're having this session, blurt out or raise your hand or throw something at me and we'll have a dialogue right then. And if it gets really off quite a ways and it seems real interesting, we'll follow it. So don't be afraid to do that. All right, so first we're going to look at just war, only it's not just war. It is the justifiable war tradition. It is that. It's a theory or tradition. It isn't a list of characteristics, which you often get when they talk about just war. It has evolved as a social argument from the time starting back after Constantine. And actually, it started even further back as far as Cicero, to think about, you know, when can you use violence? You know, when, if, you know, there is a necessity to protect the other. And where the Christian tradition really starts, it's not self-defense. If Bill was attacking me, the Christian tradition is, ancient tradition is, I do not use violence against him. The Christian tradition is that if Bill is attacking me, Michael has an obligation out of love of neighbor, me being the neighbor, he can use what means he needs to use to stop Bill from attacking me. So the whole idea of self-defense, you know, in our tradition, in our societal usage, you know, be it court or be it wars or anything else, you know, always has to do with us protecting ourselves rather than love of neighbor, us only protecting the other. Okay, the problems with the justifiable war tradition are, the first two we've kind of all talked about. The biggest problem with the justifiable war tradition isn't really the justifiable war tradition. There's really, if you look at these criteria, and we will tonight, there's probably no way in modern times you could have a so-called just war. It has pretty strong strictures. The real problem is leakage. There is something, basically there are three ways in the modern world of looking at war. One is justifiable war tradition, one is pacifism, and one is called war realism. War realism basically is based on an idea of power. Justifiable war tradition is based on justice. Pacifism or nonviolence is based on love. War realism, the theory behind war realism is that you use as much power in an overwhelming fashion, as fast and as devastating a form as you can use it, so that the enemy is so crushed that the enemy will never try again, and you will therefore get peace. The leakage problem is what happens when we get into these situations. Those kinds of theories, it's also called the Powell theory in, you know, in the last 10 years, because Colin Powell, and it's a common, you know, military thought process. Think of shock and awe. I mean, that's what it was. It was actually trying to avoid the war by showing there was so much power, might as well just give up right now. And, of course, that was 7 years ago, and there's still killing going on in the streets of Baghdad, so it didn't work at that time. But the real problem is there's a leakage between that war realism and justifiable war tradition. And you can see it in what people say during the wars, and you can see it what the politicians say before the wars, and, you know, there's all of this so-called realism about how we have to win on the ground in order to bring peace. And also, there are just defects in the reasoning, and I'd like to point out a couple of those as we go historically. One of those defects really starts from the historical standpoint of Augustine. This is Augustine's teacher, Ambrose. But Augustine and Ambrose came along at a time, who knows when Constantine allegedly became a Christian?
300.
Yep, I think it was 323. So these guys are coming along right after that. It's also at the time of the demise of the Roman Empire. And once Christianity became normative, and there were a lot of Christians, and it was kind of the state religion, and the Roman Empire was sinking, there was a lot of political pressure and grumbling about, you Christians are causing our empire to crumble. And so Augustine was in a position of being apologetic for Christianity and its principles, and it was politically expedient for him to craft a theory by which Christianity could be reconciled with war and violence. And so
as a lawyer in court, what I would say, if I had that information on someone as to their position, I could undermine the credibility of the theory because of the self-interest. So here's what Ambrose says, and he says, you know, this thing that we just worked out with Michael and Bill and I. You know, that Michael can use violence against Bill to save me. I can't use violence against Bill to save myself. He also said some good things, like this. Law calls for reciprocal violence. The gospel commands love for hostility, goodwill for hatred, and prayers for curses. And these guys were wonderful theologians, but they were in pickle politically. Okay, so basically, Augustine said, no, there are situations where we Christians think it's our right to go to war. And basically, he justified it as rooted in love of neighbor, that is, protection of the other. And he said that there's got to be just cause, there's got to be right authority, has to be right intention, and the end of peace. The thing that I'm hoping Dan can shed some light on. And this list gets a little longer as it goes down through history, and we'll spend a little time on each of those, but those are kind of the essence of what he was saying. Just cause, that's usually, you have been, almost always at this time, you have been attacked by someone else. There is someone else who is an aggressor, and your group or nation or whatever it is trying to defend themselves. Right authority, it has to be decreed in his view by someone who is in power. This is a very interesting requirement, because as you'll see it come down through history, what it really means is much more than the president would say we've got to go. It means that there has to be enough discernment and publicity, that is, it is widely disseminated through the public, the international public, to know that it is an appropriate thing to do. For instance, in the Iraq War, in order to have right authority, we should have had approval from the UN, because there you have an international opinion-making body. And we tried to get authority, and what happened for the Iraq War? Did the UN say, yes, you can attack Iraq? No, exactly the opposite. France and China at least vetoed anything, and we didn't get approval. And so right authority means a lot more than the commander-in-chief saying go. International publicity is the current word for right authority. Right intention means you don't have an ulterior motive. You don't have a motive of, economic motive, heroism motive, vengeance motive, any of those sort of things. You're only doing it to bring peace. That is the end of peace. All right, I want to say something about Augustine's thought. Can you guys see this at all? Yeah. Augustine was a Stoic, and there's a huge problem in the way he thought about things, and you can understand, if you understand Stoic thought, why he thought that way. Basically, here's what he thought, the bottom line. Let necessity, therefore, and not your will, slay the enemy who fights you. He thought that if in your Christian heart you were pure in your motives and you had the strength of will to believe that you were acting to take the sin out of your enemy, you could take your sword, stick it through the person while loving them as a neighbor, relieving them of sin. Okay? Why did he think this way? He thought this way because, here's how some Stoics thought. They thought the human being was structured this way, in a very hierarchical way, that the human being was constructed of four levels. Concupiscence, which basically is some of the most basic drives, such as, sexual drive. Irascibility, which
has to do with more getting up to about here, that is power, physical strength, how you physically act, reason, you know, what you think, what your ideas are, and will at the top of them all. Will being like, you know, your intentions that can be guided, you know, by divine or evil. And that will controlled reason, and reason controlled irascibility, and irascibility controlled concupiscence. Give you an idea what these are like, concupiscence. And then they said, all of us in any of those areas can either go for the good or go for the bad, vice or virtue. So concupiscence, you could either go, you could be depraved, or you could be temperate. Irascibility, you could be a wimp, didn't have courage, or you could have great fortitude. Reason, you could be ignorant if it was a vice, or you could be prudent if it was a virtue. And will, you'd be malevolent, that is, you know, you could be mean, or you could be driven by justice. And since he believed this is how the human worked, and we were out of love of neighbor, and that was just, he believed we could have right intention while doing violence or being in war. Now, do human beings work like that? I'm just reading this book. I wasn't reading the book. Petter was reading the book. You hear Petter?
He's with Thisbe.
My son-in-law's reading the book, so I picked it up one night after I go back up there. It's called Matterhorn. Anyone read? I just doubt it. It's about the Vietnam War. So instead of this view that you can remain pure and of loving at the time of war, this is actually what it's like. This guy who wrote it's an Oxford scholar. He was in Vietnam. He got all sorts of awards. Brilliant guy. This is a novel. The protagonist is Melas, and that's basically, you can tell this is largely autobiographical. This is right during the time in the middle of battle when he's deciding to go do this heroic thing. Melas was transported outside himself, beyond himself. It was as if his mind watched everything coolly while his body raced wildly with passion and fear. He was frightened beyond any fear he had ever known. But this brilliant and intense fear, this terrible here and now, combined with the crucial significance of every movement of his body, pushed him over a barrier whose existence he had not known about until this moment. He gave himself over completely to the God of war within him. This is what really happens. Have any of you read any Chris Hedges, War is a Force that Gives Us Meaning, and those sorts of things, about he talks about what a narcotic war is? Then he wrote a few paragraphs later about after the battle and if there is a victory, and he characterizes that. And see, you know, where on this level over here, if we're still up in, we certainly weren't pure when we were in the midst of battle, giving ourselves over to the God of war. He says, victory in combat is like sex with a prostitute. For a moment you forget everything in the sudden physical rush, but then you have to pay your money to the woman showing you the door. You see the dirt on the walls and your sorry image in the mirror. So, the way Augustine thought about right intention, which is a crucial part of the justifiable war tradition, I take the position is fundamentally flawed. So fundamentally flawed that as a tradition, it just is defective. Okay, here's the next thing. And Augustine was wonderful. You know, in seminary we read City of God and all sorts of things that he wrote. Just unbelievable theologian and wonderful heart. But here's what he did that was worse than the last thing. He said that just war tradition not only could include, as a basis, love of neighbor, but also right worship. So, so that if someone else wasn't worshiping right, that could justify your use of violence. And he wrote this, while those who are better guided are right by love, that is, you know, it is better to come to Christ through love and the Gospels, those are certainly more numerous who are corrected by fear. And so anyone can guess where that goes. If you think you're justified to use violence in order to bring other people to believe in worship and God the way you do, where does that lead us? The what? Okay. Aquinas actually, 800 years later, said the same thing and was right on board with it. And here's what I wanted you to think. Crusades, slavery, and empire. Because, you know, think of what happened down in South America with all of the indigenous people who didn't believe. There had to be an excuse why you could execute all those people. Remember all the trials? That sort of thing. And the Crusades, the same thing, you know. We justified war in order to make people worship as we did, which is a much weaker justification than love of neighbor, which has some validity to it. Okay, Gratian came along in the 12th century. He was the father of canon law, a lawyer, and he published Augustine's writings. Made a contribution to the just war tradition in that he wrote it down so that it could be studied, be considered. Vittoria was another lawyer. He definitely took issue with Aquinas and Augustine about that right worship could be a reason for a just war. He thought that that was wrong. He is another contributor. Remember I said right authority really means international publicity? You know, you have to have the opinion of humanity, you know, in order to go to war. Well, he started seeing that and expanding it. Expanded right authority beyond the Sinod. Others had the right to discern whether or not war ought to be declared. And his theories really were the beginning of international law and conscientious objection. He was the first one, and he started standing up for the fact that, you know, you could have a conscientious objection and not have to participate in war if it was based on religious or moral beliefs. Grotius then was the father of international law. This was more secular than sacred. He also talked about public declarations of war and solidified conscientious objection. He was a huge contributor to some good modifications of this justifiable war tradition. So here are the justifications for going to war. First, there has to be just cause. When President Bush ordered Chakanaw to begin in Iraq, he came on and he says, our cause is just. And then he talked about weapons of mass destruction. We're well protected. That's love of master rather than love of neighbor.
Just cause.
And just cause, oftentimes, just cause is confused with just war. That is, if your cause is just, it's okay. Well, it's only one of the many criteria. And wars of aggression, since 1928, have been the cardinal international crime. So you can't strike first, except in the most limited situations, which, of course, we did in Iraq. The UN Charter defines what just cause can be. And there's a strong presumption against war, rather than a presumption. That's what this whole thing now, when we're talking about violence, is. How do people think? I was here, living here, on 9/11, and as soon as it happened, we were waiting for the bombs to start falling. Now, where are you going to drop them? You know? Kansas, Mexico, China. I mean, okay, we'll choose Afghanistan. I mean, it was just like the presumption was going to be we go to war, even though we don't know where to do it or how to do it. rather than a presumption against war. No one talks about that in justifiable war tradition, and in the bishop's statement that came out after Vatican II, there's a strong presumption against war. That's why it takes time. You need to build international coalitions. You have to look at all the other alternatives. So just cause is only to protect innocent life, to preserve conditions for decent human existence, and to secure basic human rights. It is not for, and here's the list that, you know, probably every war is fought for, self-interest, glory, empire. So just cause is more than just, you know, politically we think we should be able to go after an enemy. Right intention, this is the thing I was talking about with Augustine, is to establish justice and peace. It's based on loving and working the enemy, and we are to have sorrow and regret for damage and killing cause. In other words, if I took the sin out of this man by killing him, not only would I have to believe I was loving him, I would have to be sorrowful for the act that occurred. Not, here's the knots again, which you can tell this is what war is: revenge, cruelty, love of violence, hatred, lust for power, pride, and self-seeking. So even way back then, you know, they looked at these terms. Last resort, all reasonable alternatives have been exhausted, and they're set right out in the UN Charter, among others. Before the Iraq invasion, I was there with Christian peacemakers, and I was convinced nobody in that country I talked to liked Saddam Hussein. International opinion was focused on him. I don't know what nonviolent strategy was going to work, but I knew for sure that it would work and he would be taken out of power without ruining their country and killing hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians. Patience. That's all we needed as a last resort, was some patience. Yes, sir.
They also, our government also had the backing of most Desert Storm veterans also. The backing of the eyewitness accounts of what we saw there when we were in Kuwait. And like when war first started, and I disagree with it now, when war first started, we all supported it because they made the claim of weapons of mass destruction. And that was backed up by us because, I mean, my friends and I, right there at Equator National Airport, we saw bunker after bunker after bunker after bunker of chemical weapons storage. So they had the complete backing of weapons of mass destruction. We're like, yeah, they're there. They knew it. We knew it was there. But 10 years of bad intelligence doesn't excuse going in on bad intelligence the second time.
And when I was in Baghdad, I saw the trucks going out every morning. The vans and the trucks of the weapons inspectors, they were gone all over the country. We had access.
Everywhere.
We had access to them. And they weren't finding them. And the weapons inspectors that were there in 93, before they got kicked out, had observed the destruction of many, many, many of those old weapons, most of them like chemical weapons. So there's lots of different last resorts.
Yeah.
Probability of success. This is end of peace now. When everything's over with, before you go into a just war, start to defend yourself. You're supposed to be able to tell with reasonable possibility that there will either be, that the outcome will be better than having the war. That it'll be good enough so you'll have an end of peace. That things will end up so you got the best chance of peace. So, I'd like to have Dan just, you know, maybe I could write some of them. You talk them, or you could write some of them, whatever. Talk about, you know, what is the answer to that question, how do we find peace? From a standpoint of Christian belief, and then of kind of the classic empire and their theory of how they impose peace, which
time in the Roman Empire.
I began this very brief because they'll have a chapel over there. So, but we're talking two types of peas, the Pax Christi and the Pax Romana. Now, when we often think of the term pacifism, which would be on this side, it's often thought of this as being wimpy or just laying down arms and let them run over us. Is that often kind of the pacifists are the ones that won't help, won't take up arms, and will allow themselves to be run over. And therefore, the most popular of these, of course, is the Pax Romana, an empire or a government that thinks they're good, arms, and this will keep war from happening, and if it does, the enemy will be easily destroyed and peace returned. And I want to give two illustrations of the difference. Because what we need to understand this position is to see pacifism as not a form of being wimpy, but it is a form of power. Just a brief story to start, to give us an idea of what power means. We had a staff person up here years ago at Holden, her name Maggie Ferris, and she had had an intensive nonviolent training. And in Minneapolis, she was jogging in the park one evening, and there was only one little place where she couldn't be seen, going around some bushes. And this man jumped out of the bushes and grabbed her. And she got turned enough so she could look at him in the face, and she ordered him, she said, "You and I are going to have a talk. Right now, the two of us are going to walk down to that park bench, and there we are going to talk." And he was so surprised by this, he did. And then she sat there with him. And then he began to tell his life story about how he had been abused. He told his story about being in Vietnam and the mental anguish from being in the Vietnam War. And they talked and they talked and they talked. And finally she says, "You know, it's starting to get dark. Would you walk me home? Because I'm afraid somebody might." And sure enough, he did. She did use one deception in this. She says, "My husband will be worried about me, and he's at home." And so he walked her home. He never knew she didn't have a husband. This is called being as wise as serpents. And then so said goodbye. And in the morning, she opened the door, and there was a milk bottle there. And it had a flower coming out of it. And there was a little note saying, "Thank you. No one has ever listened to me before." So now, just from this, it gives us an opening that there's a form of power that can actually respond to violence. Now, going back to Scripture, you can, if you remember, the time when Jesus faced an angry mob, and what happened is they were going to throw him over a cliff, and he walked right through them and went on his way. And if you saw the movie Gandhi, you might remember the angry crowd. And he walked towards that crowd with a look of confidence and love on his face. And they were so startled by that that they actually moved out of the way. And he went through. Now, and of course, the stories of Gandhi we've heard, what very few of us have heard that there was a disciple of Gandhi in, I may be wrong, but in Pakistan, they were also under the British. And this person learned the techniques of Gandhi, and he took hundreds and hundreds of violent warrior tribespeople and taught them the principles of violence. And they drove the British out of their country by the sheer power of the type of love that Gandhi had taught them. It's the hardest thing in the church to begin to understand that when Jesus was saying, turn the other cheek, he was not saying, just roll over. Just roll over. And then I'll close with this about turning the other cheek. Was about when Jesus said, turn the other cheek, and it's Walter Wink that was mentioned this week, that taught us that in the time of Jesus, there was very, very strict customs about how you could hit somebody. And Jesus was teaching them that the normal way for a power person and a lower person to be controlled was to strike them backhanded like that. I don't have time to really explain this, but in that time, by Jesus saying, turn the other cheek, that person who was persecuting you, in order to hit you, there was very strict customs about you hit another person related to purity and cleanse, and they would have to contort themselves into the strangest position in order to hit.
Here, I have a slave for you, Dan.
What?
I have a servant for you.
Oh, good. You're going to hit me? Okay. Okay, now I'm going to... No, you hit me there, right? Okay, now I'm going to turn the other cheek.
So I'd have to hit him like this if I was going to hit him.
Say it real loud.
I'd have to hit him like this if I was going to hit him,
okay.
Which is a sign of that he's not my equal.
Yeah, it's a sign that we are equals. Also, there's the, to hit with the back side, you'd have to contort mm-hmm. yourself into a rather powerless position. And always in the teaching of Jesus, in nonviolent teaching, is to grab that moment, like Maggie did, grab a moment when you have been trained on how to surprise a person, and then, in the midst of that surprise, respond with love. And another woman who had lots of nonviolence training, she lived alone. And she heard somebody break into her house and coming down the hall. And when the person walked in, she turned on the lights real fast, looked at him in the eye, and says, "What time is it?" And then he got all rattled, looked for his watch. And his and then by that time, she had taken the power in that situation, and then they had a talk, and then he left. But the importance is, it always won't work, and that's when Jesus said, deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. But it has as much possibility, and maybe more, because does war and violence work? And this is always the here the possibility that there is another way. And why can't congregations become training places for the very form of power that Jesus meant when he said, take up your cross and follow me? That wasn't too long. It wasn't so long.
Thanks, Dan. Just in great summary, Pax Christi bases the end of peace, that is trying to arrive at peace, on covenant with God, nonviolence, community, and love. That's the Christian idea about coming to peace. The empire's idea about coming to peace back in here, and oftentimes in the, it's a good summary of what goes on today, is based upon tradition or pieties of your national idols, strength rather than love, war, victory, and victory to lead to control and the end of chaos, and therefore an end of peace. So basically the difference, and as you heard some of these things, and we'll hear about more, it basically comes down to Pax Christi talking about relationship as being, in terms of community and love, as being the end of peace, and Pax Romana relying on domination. And that's, of course, what the entire history has been, you know, for probably 2,000 years, but at least, you know, in terms of our country, for 200 years. So, now, what time is it?
We got
a couple minutes. Let me just give you some anecdotal events. Which indicate that this nonviolence can be effective. And some of them may be long-lasting, some of them may not have been, some may have been frustrated, but you can see in here almost always the germs of several things. Number one, you know, relationship, you know, and care about the other. Number two, imaginative ideas. In every situation, you know, the reason this needs to be studied is every situation is different. And so what you need to do is come up with creative ways, you know, for nonviolence in every situation. There's a whole new movement now is started by a group called the Nonviolent Peace Force. And I happen to know quite a bit about them because they're in Minneapolis and I volunteered for them and everything. And they have constructed a thing, this is one little idea, a peace army. They want a peace army that has volunteers that are ready to go any place in the world and use nonviolent techniques to areas of conflict. So it started in 2000. And they have several criteria about whether they will go in. You know, they have to be accepted by the communities there, the grassroots movements. And they won't ever use violence. And they've been in Sri Lanka, they've been in Uganda, they've been in Guatemala. They're now doing a study to go into Darfur, and they're in Philippines, in Mindanao, where the worst violence is. So far they haven't lost anyone of their peace soldiers. They're soldiers without guns. They get paid $800 a month, and they have training in the culture and in the religions and in the language before they are deployed to these areas. And for instance, in Sri Lanka, there's a child soldier problem, as there are in many wars today, because the Tamil Tigers were kidnapping kids. They were running out of soldiers, arming them, and they had very, no one knew how to get them back. But
But the nonviolent peace force had been living in those areas, had established the trust of the people in those areas. And they took parents, usually moms, into the camps of the Tamil Tigers, and they'd say, I want my child back. And they got their children back. If the mom had gone into that camp alone, she probably never would have come on. And they did it in a way, like Dan was saying, with confidence and with assuredness, and when they walked in, it worked. I mean, and it's not always going to work, but they haven't lost anyone yet so far. They had one peacekeeper kidnapped in Mindanao. He's gone for 3 months. And they didn't agree to stop working. They didn't pay any money. They didn't, you know, negotiate at all except to ask for his return. And after 3 months, he was returned. Sooner or later, probably one of those peacemakers will be killed. But they're proving on the ground as we sit here now that these things can work.
Where did they get the money for the $800?
From you. Not taxpayers, just people. People sending money in.
Okay.
Yep. And they have so many places. They have 14 places in the world right now that are dying for them to come. And as soon as they get enough money, they'll train the people. And the amazing thing about this, for every time when they're going to do a deployment, they'll send out notices. Look up Nonviolent Peace Force on the, you know, internet. You can get it in French or English. Or, they always have at least 20 applications for every opening. They have so many people who want to do this because they're like people who are sitting in this room. So they got plenty of conflict and they've got some wonderful ideas. Only needs a little more money and they can keep spreading this. But their idea is to have a trained peace force of 2,000 people that are ready to go, and enough money to be able to pay them so that when a conflict arises and they get a request to be there, they can send people. Okay, well, I haven't done any of my background stuff, but let me, I'll do a couple. And then, this started back in 258 BC, the first one I had heard about. It was the plebeians, and they were basically, you know, a lower class than the slaves in Rome. And they had two different actions of nonviolent resistance. One was when they didn't believe that they were being adequately compensated for their work, they had a work stoppage. That's one of many things. You know, there's work stoppages, there's marches, there's all sorts of things you can think about. And they went to the Sacred Mount. And 200 years later, many of these same people were in the army and they came back to Rome. And Rome had not treated them properly as soldiers, so they went to the same mount, the Sacred Mount. It's a mountain outside of Rome. And on both occasions, the Roman Senate, even though these people were loyal people, took action and gave them reparations. In 1776, there was, before the war started, there was such economic resistance going on and political resistance going on, nonviolent, that it is thought by many scholars that the war was going to be completely unnecessary. Later during 1795, Governor Bernard of Massachusetts Bay said, this is the governor for King George, at this time I have no real authority in this place. They had set up an entirely separate economic system outside of the British system. And in another technique that's frequent, in the Virginia House of Burgess, Thomas Jefferson made a motion and they had a day of fasting against the oppression and illegalities of the British king. They had so undermined British authority in the United States by these methods, you know, purely nonviolent, that it may well have been, we didn't need to go through that whole war. In 1883, Lincoln, we were coming up to the Civil War, and Lincoln,
63?
63,
the war was ongoing.
Was it? It was ongoing?
Mm-hmm.
He called a national fast day proclamation. He asserted the biblical claim that a nation so blessed with liberty and equality can long endure only as it continually passes through the crucible of national self-interrogation and repentance, especially when the crucible comes during time of war. So, President Lincoln saw the value in fasting. In 1917, the Tsar was under extreme pressure, and his soldiers were shooting people in the Red, in what's now known as the Red Square. There were bodies all over the place. The people kept marching. The soldiers finally got to a point where they wouldn't shoot anyone anymore. And the Tsar was done. They wouldn't pull the trigger. That's a nonviolent action. Spontaneous, not even planned. World War I. Any of you hear about the soccer game in World War I?
Yes.
Wonderful story. The next day when they're supposed to start shooting, they wouldn't shoot at each other. They had to get the troops out from both sides and bring new troops in. Who'd do it? In 1940, when the Nazis invaded Norway, the Nazis installed some Norwegians who were, willing to run a totalitarian government that was sympathetic to the Nazis. And one of the things they wanted to do was start teaching the kids Nazi propaganda. So the teachers in Norway decided they would not teach this. And so they arrested 1,000 of the male teachers and sent them to a prison. And the other teachers still wouldn't teach it. And there were silent marches, and there was resistance, and there was a withdrawal of consent. Another tactic, not a tactic, a withdrawal of consent to follow that government. Finally, they gave up. And they allowed the teachers to come back, and they taught reading, writing, and arithmetic without any Nazi propaganda. In 1943, in the middle of Berlin, the Jewish persecution and Holocaust proceeded along various lines. One of the latter groups to be taken were Jewish men who were married to non-Jewish German women. So they rounded all of them up and put them in prison. And the prison was in Berlin. And the non-Jewish women came out on the corner and started yelling. They wanted their husbands back. And you can imagine, the Nazis in 1943. They had machine guns, everywhere in Berlin. They could have wiped these women out in 2 minutes. So they went out with them, and they pleaded with them, just to break it up and, go home. So they finally talked them into going home. The next morning, they came out and started yelling again. And the Nazi bureaucrats and politicians were just really at odds. They were afraid of popular opposition. They didn't know what to do. The third day, they came and started yelling again. They invited the women in, and they gave them coffee and tea and said, "No, why don't you be good little girls and just go home?" And the fourth day, they kept yelling, and they let their husbands go back to them.
Wow.
Petition. And we got to stop, but here's what I have down for other things. 44, nonviolent revolution in Guatemala. 48, the British Empire was done in India by nonviolence. 68, Martin Luther King ended segregation. 73, Thailand brought down their dictatorship. Early 80s, Poland in solidarity and work stoppages brought down the Communist Party. 1988 in Burma, Aung San Suu Kyi began to undermine that government. It's not over. There's the military junta is still in charge, but it's ongoing. 1986, the Philippines had the intervention. They got rid of Marcos as the troops backed down. 1989, Tiananmen Square. The first group of soldiers in Tiananmen Square were given gifts and were given messages of goodwill, and they were from Beijing, and they backed down. China then had to go out and get different troops from North China to come down and do the the shooting and killing. 1989, there's a list of, I have about 20 more. I'll just tell you one more and we'll stop. 1989 in East Germany, the worst dictator in the communist bloc was Erich Honecker, and he had a group of Secret Service called, yes, Stasi. They were absolutely terrible, and there'd never been a protest there. And there was protest day after day, and they were starting to build. And finally, Honecker called Stasi in, and he said, go shoot them. And Stasi said no. Stasi said no. 24 hours later, Honecker was on a jet to Moscow, or he would have been dead. And 24 hours after that, the Berlin Wall was being taken down. Completely nonviolent and spontaneous. Maybe let's close with prayer. Please join me. God of all ages and times, we give you thanks for your presence among us. We thank you for creating us in your image, binding us together as one human family. Open our eyes so that we may see your face in all those around us. Strengthen us so that we may reflect your wisdom in all we say and do. Amen. Amen.